Welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. One of our neighbors is the country's probably among the most, if not the most articulate and influential spokesman for the poor of our country. It's Chapel Hill's Gene Nickel, the Boyd Tinsley Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity. He's also the former dean of the law school. He speaks and writes passionately about the poor and about the policies of our government and our attitudes about poverty. And Gene Nickels, thanks for coming and talking to us. I'm reading the Bible through right now, and I'm in the middle of the prophets, and you fit.
Oh.
You fit in that category.
I was going to start by saying that introduction was way overblown off the top and too kind. And now you turn to the Old Testament, so I said this the other day. I was giving a talk somewhere, and they gave me an overly blossomed introduction. And I said, if George W. Bush taught us anything, it's the value of diminished expectations. Let me tamp that down and say it's great. It's great to be here with an old friend and spend some time with you.
Well, thanks for coming. You are writing, I think, monthly, a monthly column in the News and Observer, and it's important in terms of focusing both on what's going on right today and then what the long-range impact of the policies that we're adopting. And it's easy enough to say this is all the current legislature's fault, these Tea Party people who are in. The thing that impacts me the most is what you're saying to me about how I'm living my life and what I'm doing to and not doing with respect to the enormity of the challenge. But take us from ground zero about what a North Carolinian ought to know and take into account in terms of what progress we're making in terms of addressing the questions of poverty, what opportunities they are, and what the payoff might be if we were doing a better job of working with the potentially contributing people in our poor population.
You've just asked like the hugest question in the world. So, but I think it's a good preface in that one aspect of what you were suggesting, I believe very strongly, as energetic an opponent I am, as I am of the what's happened in the legislature in this session and the one before, to be candid. These are not new problems. The depth of North Carolina poverty is being made worse by these folks in Raleigh, but North Carolina poverty has been intense for a long time. Here's one way I try to highlight that for folks is poverty rose significantly in North Carolina from 2000 to 2008 as the economy was growing and expanding, as we tended to say, folks are doing well. Poverty was rising. And then, of course, we had the Great Recession and the wheels came off of the economy and poverty mushroomed by all of its measures. Poverty levels, child poverty levels, food insecurity or hunger, unemployment, unemployment insurance, lack of health care coverage. These problems became much more intense, but they existed even before we had the rigors of this legislative session. The way I try to explain to people is, well, we had Democrats in power for a long time who ignored poverty. It can be worse. You can have a legislature like we have now, which in effect wages war on the poor. So there can be things that are worse than poverty, but worse than ignoring poverty. But the intensity of poverty in North Carolina is a powerful betrayal of what we say we stand for, what the sort of history of this state's struggles towards progress have been aiming at. Here's a simple marker on that, DG. 40% of the children of color in North Carolina live in poverty. And that's wrenching poverty, challenging, immensely distressing poverty. I try to ask people, and let that soak in for a minute. This is the richest nation on earth. 40% of our children of color live in wrenching poverty. I would think that that statement alone is sort of a confession of failure as a Commonwealth, an indication that we have not done what we say we believe in. We sort of haven't lived up to the things we think we teach our children. Many people have just the opposite view, I've got to concede. But you can start with that. How can we be the wealthiest nation on earth and have levels of child poverty which are radically different than all the other advanced countries? And then when you add race to it, it marks our failure as a people.
Can I interrupt you just because this is a challenge that I've got in both in my own mind and also in discussing with other people. There is this idea about that as bad as poverty is, it is sort of the price that society pays for an economic system that depends on entrepreneurism, on people working hard and reaping the rewards of their work, mm-hmm. and that as a consequence, those who, for one reason or another, are not able to participate or do not have the super qualities that allow them to participate, consequently have to live in poverty. What you suggest is that there are other entrepreneurial nations and societies where they are able to achieve this idea of those who work hard can have success, but also that doesn't necessarily mean that there has to be a category of people who don't participate to the highest level who are going to be suffering in poverty. So you argue that, say, for instance, European countries where you can get rich if you work hard don't have the same degree of poverty.
No, that's right. In fact, it's not just the European countries. It's not just Sweden and Norway, like we tend to think. Of the 35 advanced democracies, wealthier democracies, in other words, we have the highest poverty rates. We're the richest, but we have the highest poverty rates of any of them, the highest child poverty rates of any of them. We have the largest gaps between rich and poor of any of them. Not only there of the advanced countries, in fact, you have to go all the way to the bottom of all of the nations of the world to find our peers in terms of inequality. I think gaps between rich and poor, our colleagues are Madagascar, Ecuador, Cameroon. We're way past any European nations, any Commonwealth nations. In terms of gaps between rich and poor, we're way past India and China. Were they?
Whoa.
Yes, between rich and poor.
The gap between rich and poor.
The gap between rich and
poor.
In other words, income inequality. Not poverty, but income inequality. Now, I mention that because in India and China, they have demonstrations over income inequality. We tend not to. So we are a wild outlier on this. Even given that, we're the country that talks the most about equality. We pledge our allegiance to it. We write it up in our constitutional charters. We put it in the Declaration of Independence. So we're the nation that talks the most about equality but does the least. Lastly, on the economic point, folks used to say, well, we have greater poverty, but we have this great income mobility. I think that's part of the claim that they would make. That's just part of the cost of this dynamic capitalist system we have. But we now have the worst income mobility among the advanced nations too. So in the United States, if you were born poor, you're far more apt to stay poor than other advanced nations. If you're born wealthy, you're far more apt to stay wealthy than other advanced nations. So even if you could put together an argument that, well, we have to have tons of people in poverty so that the very richest 1% can get more than they would at other places, it's a hell of an unappealing moral claim, it seems to me.
Visiting with Gene Nichols, we're talking about poverty. He and I'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our neighbor in Chapel Hill, Gene Nickel. We're talking about poverty, and that's his profession. He's the director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the UNC School of Law, former dean of the school, and also, of course, a professor of law.
Right. That's my actual profession. I am a constitutional law professor by trade, and I still do that full time. So,
well, let's don't get off on that, but it's incredible to me how you can do all of this. But what we're talking about really is our poverty, that is the poverty in the United States, sort of compared to the poverty of other countries. And you mentioned India, and you mentioned that the disparity between rich and poor which seems to be pronounced in India, is actually less than our
yes.
disparity.
Yes.
But it raises the other question, and this is often something that I think is worth, it's a point that's worth discussing, and that is that to be poor in the United States is not as bad by any means as being poor in India. And so that rings a bell with me when I see, you know, these kids crowded in these neighborhoods in Mumbai and in Calcutta. I mean, you know, without anything to eat, scraping by, working at 5 and 6 years old. Our poor are not as bad off as those.
No, they are not. And poverty in India is worse than poverty in the United States. I used to do a good bit of work in the Dominican Republic. Poverty in the Dominican Republic and Haiti is worse than it is in the United States. It astonishes me how many Americans, American policymakers, American conservatives, think that given that fact, our obligations are over. If poverty is not worse or not as bad in Eastern North Carolina as it is in New Delhi, then we can relax, unconcerned. We have no obligations beyond that. Poverty is worse in the United States than it is in all of the advanced Western democracies, all of the countries that it would make any sense to compare us with. Now, it may be that we have some political figures who think as long as our poverty is not as bad as it is in Indonesia or as bad as it is in India, then we're fine. We have no obligations one to another. But I can't believe seriously that any person of either constitutional or religious ethic would take that view. I mean, we dedicate ourselves to principles of equality and justice and dignity, and yet we have a society which is more potently skewed than any of the major industrial societies. And you can use a lot of excuses, I guess we could say, to accept that. You can use a lot of excuses to say we're not bound by the religious tenets which we all claim to the least of these. We're not bound by the constitutional things to which we pledge allegiance, like liberty and justice for all. And the reason we're not is, you know, I read something in a book, and hell, it's even worse in India. So if you don't have a decent chance at an education, you don't have a decent chance at access to the justice system, you don't have a chance to eat, you don't have a chance to get transportation, you don't have any access to health care, well, buck up, buddy, because it's worse in Mumbai. It seems to me if that's the position of our leadership, if that's the position of sort of political figures, then they have at least lost the promise of America. They have at least lost the underpinnings of what we say we stand for as a society. And I think sort of like Lincoln, you say maybe at least let's do away with some of the grotesque hypocrisy. Maybe we could strike the Declaration of Independence from the books or quit pledging allegiance to things that we reject so profoundly.
I want to shift gears for a minute, Gene Nickel, and talk about us here in Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're passionate and persuasive as you discuss these things. But nevertheless, what I do is I get up in the morning and I drink my coffee and read my paper and walk around a very pleasant place to live on the campus of the University of North Carolina. And so I'm missing seeing some of these things you're talking about. You must have thought about what you'd say to somebody like me and say, DG, if you don't believe it, go look at some place in Chapel Hill or Durham or some place down in Chatham County where people just go drive through their neighborhood and get a look at what's going on or go visit a particular school. Have you got an itinerary for people who need to be persuaded?
You don't have to travel far, as you know. There is significant poverty in Orange County. There is homelessness in Chapel Hill. There are marked homelessness. We spent some time looking at homeless issues in Durham. You don't have to move far outside of the Governor's Club or whatever it is. Is that what it's called down there? To see intense poverty moving towards Siler City. But if you want to be more ambitious, you can go to Eastern North Carolina. It's not very far. It's not the other side of the moon. We have 10 persistent poverty counties as designated by the federal government in Eastern North Carolina. That means that they've had at least 20% poverty rates or higher, significantly higher, for over 30 years. Now, in those 10 Eastern North Carolina persistent poverty counties, we use the measure the federal government gives us, which is this very high levels of poverty for 30 years, but they could have said 100. They could have said 150 in a regime that goes back to slavery and is directly related from the fallouts of it. We did a poverty tour, the Poverty Center and the NAACP and the Justice Center and good colleagues over at North Carolina Central. You can see the depths of poverty all over North Carolina. You don't have to go far. I'll give you a little story in this. We were working in Hickory with a group that does remarkable work. And there's a sort of astonishingly large homeless community in Hickory, and they can't the local shelter.
This is just for anybody. I mean, everybody knows where Hickory is, but it's west between Charlotte and Nashville, in the furniture manufacturing arena where there are a lot of lost jobs.
Lots of lost jobs. Hickory has one of the Hickory metropolitan area has one of the highest increases in unemployment in the last 10 years in the United States. So maybe this is not stunning, I guess, but you walk a few hundred yards into the woods in Hickory and just down from very nice houses and churches, and there are over 200 people living in the woods, living in sort of tents, makeshift tents and cardboard lean-tos. They get rousted out by the police, I guess not surprisingly, and sadly they rip up their tents, frequently their only possessions. And we've been doing some work with folks down there from the Open Door Ministries, and they minister to that community. And one of their great frustrations is the large churches in Hickory down the way, they will send their kids off to foreign missionary trips, and they will raise money to do that. But they don't want them to work in the homeless community, which in that case is, I don't know what it is, like 800 yards away in some of the woods. So we have a lot of attention.
I want to argue with you for just a minute because, but you're absolutely right. But just recently, I've been turned on by the reports of young people, primarily high school kids who've been to Haiti or been to Atlanta or the Appalachia and found out what it's like to be poor by visiting other places. Then they come back home and some of them do see what's going on in their own community better than what they did before.
You know, I was at William & Mary for a while, and they the students there who were remarkable and idealistic, and they would go on foreign, I mean, these international exchanges, and I went with them sometimes, and they would see very intense poverty. When it was working its best, when that those exchange programs were working their best, then they would look just down the road from Williamsburg, not very far, in Petersburg, Virginia, and they would see really intense poverty that in some ways paralleled what they'd seen in Haiti or the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, that's what I'm –
And they would begin to work in Petersburg. And that's – I'm just saying that's when I felt like – I mean, I love the international focus, and it is – I would never deny that poverty is worse in some parts of the world than it is in the United States, but – we have intense poverty right here, which we ignore. One of the lucky things in my life, when I was somewhat younger, I worked some with Paul Wellstone, the senator from Minnesota. And Paul used to say that.
I just ran by his bench on the North Carolina campus.
So
it's a reminder that the influence of our university in national affairs is pronounced. And excuse me for interrupting you.
What Paul would say is one of the largest problems of American life is that we turn our gaze away from those locked at the bottom. And I think what he meant by that is this. Maybe our kids are doing well. Our kids here in Chapel Hill are doing well. Maybe their friends are doing well. Their friends, our friends' kids and their cousins and far-flung associations. Maybe there's poverty. Maybe there's some intense poverty, but it's on the other side of the tracks, or it's on the other side of the county, or sometimes here it's maybe on the other side of the state. And maybe it's even so pronounced, that poverty, that it gives the lie to our claims of equal opportunity and a level playing field and equal dignity and the like. But it's over there, sort of far away. And so what we do, I think Paul would say, is we turn our gaze away from it. We look to more congenial quarters, and we say that, oh, this is – no, things are going fine. This is an immensely appealing source of opportunity and dignity. But only by turning our gaze away from those locked at the bottom are we able to do that. I say this. There are three facts that lie at the vortex of American poverty. One is, this is the richest nation on earth, the richest nation in human history. That's fact one, incontestable, it seems to me. Second, we have more poverty, particularly more child poverty, than any other advanced nation. That's incontestable. Third, Americans believe almost to the person that this is the fairest, most egalitarian, most committed to liberty and justice for all of any nation ever to inhabit the planet. Now,
I plead guilty.
But my theory is, I come from a university, so I know you can square ideas that collide if you've got enough energy and you've got enough intensity to do it. But you cannot square those three. Mm. You can't be the richest, the poorest, and the fairest all at once. Mm. But that's what we are, or that's what we think we are. And I think we pull it off by making poverty invisible in the broader society. Like what Wellstone would say is, you don't look over here or across town or across the county to these great challenges. So we turn back to more congenial atmospheres, and then we can rest confident in our assurances and in raising our hands to the Pledge of Allegiance and the like, and say, yeah, this may be the richest nation on earth, but it's also the fairest. It's just that the facts are a radical rejection of that claim.
Well, we're visiting with Gene Nickel, our neighbor, also professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Gene Nickel, who is our neighbor here in Chapel Hill, is also the director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the UNC Law School, and is also professor of law and the former dean at the law school. We're talking about poverty, and he's talking right at me. I mean, I'm not sure. I want to keep on doing
this. I'm talking to myself as much as I'm talking to you. But I live in Chapel Hill, too.
Look, there are other reactions that we give to explain or rationalize our inactivity in these areas. One of them is, okay, you know, you're right, but everything the government does or we try to do or even the churches to do to respond to the poverty, it just feeds the whole problem. It doesn't work on the long term. It doesn't help to give poor people something. What we need to do, we don't need to give them fish. We need to teach them how to fish. And there's some power to that. And so I don't want to be convinced anymore that we have a poverty problem. You convinced me. So what are some of the strategies that you all talk about at the center, taking into account the very real possibility that some of the things that we do to attack poverty in the short run might over time not be the best thing to do in the long run, and how you wrestle with those issues?
Right. Well, the dynamic that you describe, or that is the reaction to poverty that you describe, you can put it a whole bunch of different ways. What I hear all the time is, oh, God, we've been fighting poverty for 50 years, and we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's still here. Then now, I would say in the last, 10 years, I've been working on these issues for some period of time, and things have changed a little bit. I would say 20 years ago when you worked on poverty issues, the kind of public reaction or the reaction of public officials would be, oh, yeah, that's important. We're going to get to it one of these days. But, I mean, not right now. We've got to do this or that. Now it's changed with an added odd moral claim, and that was something like this. Oh, no. People like you who think we ought to do these things from the government or from the public sector or the public and private partnerships, you're actually the problem. You aid and abet poverty. What we actually need to do, and this is the moral high ground. This is a shift. The moral high ground is to ignore poor people. This is the kind of notion. Well,
that's a little harsh.
I think that's. I hear that claim a lot.
Let me stop you on that, and because this is shocking for me. This is true, and that is that good people who are responding to the critical problems of poverty say, look, the best thing we can do, and I mean this sincerely, the best thing we can do is nothing, and let the system work.
Maybe we run in different quarters, but I hear that all the time, and that is, it's an odd convenience. I think it's that, we have an economic philosophy, and a sort of political philosophy, which is that the world is going to be best served if I'm as greedy as I can possibly be. That economic philosophy has a lot of credence in the United States. What I'm trying to suggest in the last 10 years, it's been joined to a moral claim or even a religious claim that the poor are going to thrive best if they're left alone and no attention is paid.
Oh,
to
I
them.
See.
And that is so that we're going to be better off. I mean, the theory is let them die on the steps of the emergency room. Or if if kids are hungry, then maybe people are going to quit having kids.
Well, let me, but I'm trying to speak for those who are not represented here today. And that is, they would say, look, I agree, this is terrible. Mm-hmm. And here's where you and I disagree, and that is that I think what you're doing in the name of ameliorating the terrible things, Gene, what I think you're doing is hurting overall. Right. It's hurting so they really believe that these assistances to the poor, the long-term unemployment insurance, the food stamps, the things that keep people from taking care of their own problems, they really believe
I think a lot of people do believe that, and I hear that a good bit. Now, let me say a couple of things about it. First, I have this odd emotional reaction to it sometimes because actually the thing I do all the time with my life is describe poverty. My sort of public policy goal on this front has been to try to make poverty more visible in North Carolina and across the country. I actually spend modestly little time, I mean quite little time, talking about the particulars of solutions. It's funny to me, when you describe poverty, then people will have this reaction sort of from the other side. Well, you've caused it. Or what I said, do you think that we shouldn't describe it, that we shouldn't see it? Mm. Part of my belief is if we paid more attention to poverty, we would, and like we talked about this before, not wanting to assume that this is the cruelest of nations. My belief is if we made poverty more visible, that Americans would, through whatever solution, public sector, private sector, economic engine pumping, priming, that we would work more powerfully to diminish poverty. I'm saying we have the worst poverty.
So you believe your job is role that you've accepted is not to craft the perfect solution to all of this.
I do like to work on solutions, but the largest role in my life in the last 15 years has been to describe and try to shine a light on poverty. And I'm just saying it's odd that when you describe it, then people will raise holy hell and say, well, you're this welfare king and
and you say, well, I haven't. That's not what I'm talking about. What do you suggest?
What do you suggest we do? And I try to say, I am for any solution. Here's my view. We have the highest poverty and child poverty rate among the advanced nations. I'm for anything that makes it better. When I look at public policies in the government, since we have the worst poverty in the world, relatively speaking, in that sense. I look at it through this lens. I say, is what you're doing going to make life better in North Carolina for the bottom third, or is it going to make it worse? Now, sadly, under that calculation, most everything, particularly in the last couple years, is diametrically designed to make it worse for those at the bottom. And then I would add, there's also this notion that government never does any good on questions of poverty. I try to remind people of some things on that front. 1960, we start, a couple years after that, we start the North Carolina Fund. We have the War on Poverty. In 1960, over 36% of American seniors lived in wrenching poverty. Over 30% of American children lived in poverty. Now, last year, let me say first, by 1975, the poverty rate for seniors had been cut by over two-thirds. The poverty rate for kids had been cut by about 60%. Right now, in the country at large, the poverty rate for seniors is about 8 or 9%. The impact of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid in some instances, is very intense. It's not as if there's nothing that could be done. Mm. It's not as if
so maybe we should be celebratory. I mean, we could be
celebratory about what we've done in some fronts with seniors, but think of the child poverty in North Carolina. 26%.
Bill, I would argue you worry
about those young folks.
I do worry, but I think that part of the of creating a support network and a support level is in creating pride in what has been accomplished. In addition to hammering away at what we have failed to. I'm so excited about this. I want to keep on talking. I want to take a break, and then I want to come back and talk about something entirely different, if you will. And that is, you've watched the Marl Mundy development of a new way of participating in politics in North Carolina, and I'd love for you just to describe your actions on that after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with our neighbor, Gene Nickel. He is the director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity, and has, again, preached at me, and I say this worse than my wonderful minister at church when he preaches about poverty, or these Old Testament prophets who preach about the sin, about the mortal sin of living in a society where poverty is not addressed. And those prophets, like you, do not provide the detailed solutions to this. They just say you live in a society where this takes place, and therefore you're going to Babylon. You're going into exile.
But D.G., don't let me leave it with the thought that I don't believe there are solutions. There are dramatic solutions, even in terms of public policy. We have just eliminated the earned income tax credit, which is one of the strongest avenues for lifting working folks out of poverty. We made the decision here in the legislature, stunningly, that the only folks for whom you could raise, we'd have a formal increase in taxes, were people who qualified for the earned income tax credit, you know, families making about $35,000 a year. We decided to lift their taxes. They're going to have to pay more. I don't know how you look yourself in the mirror.
All right, now here's what we'll do, because you're the one who told me that although you talked about solutions, your passion was describing it, and we've begun to describe it. You just have to come back and we'll talk, and maybe bring some others to talk about some of the solutions. While I got you, tell me about, real quickly, about Marl Mundy's and what you've learned in terms, and what has happened that wasn't happening before.
Well,
in terms
it's been
of this
an
movement.
Astonishing response. That is, let me say, I'm one who was pessimistic that it could reach the intensity that it has. I think Reverend Barber probably had more confidence, rightly so, than I did on this, though I have. I'm a very potent believer in the Marl Mundy movement, but it has been huge and it's intense.
What happened and why?
Well, I think there was a series of demonstrations which were planned and triggered by the actions of the North Carolina legislature, at least initially with the frank reality that we have a legislature that's waging war on poor people in North Carolina, and that's unacceptable to the people of North Carolina. The Marl Mundys, you know, they began perhaps somewhat modestly, but very quickly they got huge and intense. And, you know, I wasn't out at, I mean, I've been to almost all of them. I wasn't out in Asheville just last week, I guess, but there were over 10,000 people, according to the sheriff, at the Marl Mundy demonstration in Asheville. We're going to go down next week to Charlotte. It's going to be huge down there. I'm looking forward to that a great deal. But you know what happened? They grew in intensity with each meeting. There is a very powerful and determined belief in what I believe is most North Carolinians, but it's at least a very it's a growing sentiment among North Carolinians that what's happening in this state is a betrayal of what this state means, a betrayal of its history, a betrayal of its aspirations, and that people are not they realize you cannot sit idly by. You also can't wait. Now, we've both done politics, DG. You can't wait for the Democratic Party to shake off the cobwebs of its everlasting confusion, and wait for the next electoral cycle. These folks are adamant to do damage, I believe, to the Commonwealth of North Carolina, which will wreak havoc and wounding, which is not going to be able to be – we can't just sit by and wait for the next election cycle hoping that they're going to overplay their hand. Maybe they will overplay their hand, but – but there's going to be damage done to poor people, excluded people, people of color,
Gene Nickel,
women.
So much more to talk about, but the clock
cannot allow. So that's what Moral Monday reflects.
Thanks to Gene Nickel for what he's doing and for his report to us. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.